Having the guests dressed to match Poe the Crow was fine, but the idea of the bridal party wearing black was a new idea to me. I guess another black dress is always useful, I said hesitantly, but I have kind of a thing about black shoes. I never wear them. Can I wear something else?
Of course you can, Shannon said. How about silver or white? I want everyone to be comfortable. At least we won't have to deal with those awful dyed-to-match things.
Later, as I turned back and forth in front of a dressing room mirror, I tried to decide between a strapless black polished cotton sheath with a side slit and a narrow rhinestone belt and a halter-top black satin mermaid number when the import of all the wedding guests wearing black and white actually hit me. Maybe that explains the black tuxedo on the dead man in the gazebo. Chapter 15. We left the bridal shop after about 4 hours of decisions and fittings. Hilda and Maureen had opted for identical short black chiffon strapless dresses, which fortunately were in stock and required only minimal adjustments. I found a strapless black polished cotton on the sale rack that fit perfectly. I knew I'd never wear it again anyway because I hate black, but everyone agreed it looked good enough. Shannon's simple white silk crepe Vera Wang sheath with spaghetti straps and a curvy little lace train was a bit more of a problem, but Corina reluctantly promised that it would be ready in 2 weeks. Therese promised to photograph the final fittings. Maureen volunteered to help select the invitations, and since the venue, the cake, and the date had been decided, it appeared that I didn't have a great deal more wedding planning to do right away. That left me time to work on prep for my upcoming debut as an investigative reporter. I passed on Shannon's invitation to join them for lunch. Therese declined, too.
I have to go to town hall and help firm up the plans for Megan's memorial tomorrow. It's not a Wiccan service, you know. We'll do that later. But since everybody knew she was a witch, Chris Rich will say a few words, and the mayor will talk about what a good citizen Megan was and how she helped to promote the city.
Therese looked ready to cry.
It won't be anything too fancy. Just some nice music and some words from people who loved her.
She wiped her eyes with the back of her hand. It was going to be a difficult day for River. For Therese, too. Megan had been an important influence in both their lives. I hugged Therese, said goodbye to Shannon, Hilda, and Maureen, and headed the vet back toward Salem. I was so deep in thought about crows and dead witches, and how to investigate the one without involving the other, that I forgot to turn my phone back on and missed 2 voicemails— one from Aunt Ibby and the other from somebody named Sean Madigan. I was already parked in the garage behind the house when I read the names. I knew I'd see my aunt in a few minutes since I was already home, so didn't bother playing her message. Madigan. There was a familiar ring to it. Took a moment, though, to remember where I'd heard it before. Dakota's best man, Sean Madigan, the art thief. What in blazes does he want? Quick debate with self. Should I treat it like an ordinary voicemail from a virtual stranger, play it back later whenever I got around to it, or would I sit here in a hot garage and listen to Sean Madigan's message immediately? Curiosity won.
Hello, Miss Barrett.
The voice was warm and pleasant.
Sean Madigan here. I guess the kids must have told you I'm Dakota's best man in the upcoming festivities. I understand you're going to stand up for the bride. I wanted to meet you at the commencement at the Tabby, but I was running late and got to the reception after you'd already left. Anyway, since we're going to be walking down the aisle together at some point, I'd like to meet you in person. I'm staying at Shannon's dad's place. Dakota's apartment was kind of crowded.
He left 2 phone numbers, one for his cell and one for the home in Marblehead. Nothing urgent or particularly interesting there. I'd call him back later. I tucked the phone back into my purse, locked the car and garage, and started up the path to the house. I looked into the branches of a nearby maple tree and tried to avoid walking under it, aware of the likelihood of roosting crows. All was quiet in the yard, and if there were crows loitering among the bright green leaves, I didn't see or hear any. Orion poked his head through the cat door, then came out and sat on the top step. I patted his fuzzy head. "Coming back inside with me? Or waiting for your girlfriends to show up?" He moved to one side but made no move to follow when I turned the key and stepped into the back hall. "Okay, see you later," I said, closing that door and knocking on Aunt Ibby's. "It's me," I called. "Come on in. It's unlocked." My aunt sat at her kitchen table, laptop in front of her, surrounded by books, many of them open. "You look super busy," I said. "What's going on?" "Didn't you get my message?" "Had my phone turned off. Sorry." I waved a hand toward the book-laden tabletop. "Was it all about this?" "Yes. Oh my, Merrily. I had no idea that crows could be so interesting. I've learned so much about them just this morning. I guess you knew the city is consulting all kinds of experts to figure out how to get rid of them at a reasonable cost. Scott Palmer said they're thinking of some kind of fireworks. It's one of the ideas. Of course, some folks are worried about that being a fire hazard. Don't want to restart the Great Salem Fire of 1914, you know. I have some notes here that you might want to include in your presentation for Mr. Doane." She waved a sheaf of papers. "That's what I called you about." "Great, thanks. What would I do without you? I'm planning to polish up my own notes and maybe go over to the station later this afternoon to make my pitch. I've been giving the whole crow thing a lot of thought." "Everyone is. I guess you didn't have a chance to watch the noon news?" "No, busy with wedding dresses. What happened?" She closed one of the open books and gathered her papers together. "I'm dying to hear about what you girls have chosen. Did you get pictures?" "Of course I did. Snapped a few with my phone. Not Therese quality, but you'll get the idea. We all really like our dresses. Now tell me, what's new on the crow scene?" "You remember Claudine Bagginstows, the woman who lost her husband a few weeks ago?"
"Yes, the banker who fell out of a tree."
"An apple tree. In his own backyard."
"The apple tree.
What about her?" "That tree that the crows picked clean? The apple tree in North Salem?"
She leaned forward on her elbows, her chin propped in one hand.
"That was in the Bagginstows' backyard, over on Dearborn Street."
"No kidding."
I was truly surprised. "This whole thing gets weirder and weirder. Mr. Bagginstows was one of the closet witches that Christopher Rich ratted on." "That was a mean thing to do," she said, shaking her head. "Mean-spirited. I'll bet poor Claudine didn't know a thing about it until that Rich person blabbed about it on television. She's such a sweet person and so devoted to her husband."
"It's all so sad. Bad enough that she lost her husband, then found out on television that he was a witch. Now more publicity she doesn't want." I felt real sympathy for Mrs. Bagginstows. I know how painful, how heartbreaking it is to lose the man you love to a sudden death. I finished my tea, showed my aunt the pictures of us and the dresses we'd chosen, and picked up the pile of crow info she'd printed out. "I'll look this over and add some of it to my presentation. Thanks so much for helping with this."
"My pleasure. Good luck with your interview. I'm sure Bruce Doane will be impressed and pleased with your industry."
"And my inexpensiveness," I added, and headed for the front stairs with Orion close behind me. Once in my own kitchen again, I looked over the material Aunt Ibby had provided. I learned that crows are extremely trainable. They have great intelligence, and they have a reputation for stealing things.
"Look, Orion," I said, pointing to the printed page.
"Crows rob food from each other, and they've been known to steal shiny things, even jewelry. They can predict tornadoes by the way they fly.
I decided to save most of Aunt Ibby's information for my actual broadcasts and to go with what I'd already prepared for my show-and-tell for Mr. Doan. My chambray shirt and jeans still looked okay. I fluffed up my hair, changed to blue kitten heels and a pair of gold hoop earrings, took a final look through my plastic-covered presentation, and I was set to go. I phoned the station to be sure the station manager was in.
"Mr. Doan said for you to come right on over," Rhonda said. "He sounds really excited about having you back on the team."
"That's good. I've missed you guys. I'll be there in a few minutes." I parked in the employees' parking area, carefully avoiding the part of the seawall where I'd looked down into the water one fall morning and discovered a body. After taking the clanking elevator up to the second floor, I enjoyed an effusive greeting from my old friend Rhonda, then found myself standing in front of the purple door marked Station Manager. I wonder what a purple door indicates in the feng shui world. Must ask River. I knocked.
"Come right in, Ms. Barrett."
I'd expected to see Mr. Doan seated behind his enormous stainless steel desk. I didn't expect to see almost the entire WICH-TV news team seated in chairs on either side of him. Scott Palmer, Phil Archer, and the recently hired Buck Covington all stood as I entered the office.
"Please join us, Ms. Barrett."
Mr. Doan indicated a high-backed mahogany chair positioned in front of his desk. I did as he asked, and the three men resumed their seats.
"I'm sure you remember Phil Archer and Scott Palmer. The new face is Buck Covington. We stole him from Channel 9. I understand you have a proposal to share with us."
Covington stood again, reaching across the desk. We shook hands. "Hi, Buck," I said. "Saw you on River's show last night." He sat, and I held up my folder. "I didn't bring copies for everybody, but that shouldn't matter. We can pass this one around if there is something special you'd like to see. Mr. Doan and I spoke Sunday about my doing some occasional short investigative news segments this summer. We'd cover things of interest to the community as a whole, topics that require a little more depth than the regular news cycle allows." I watched their expressions carefully. Phil Archer nodded in an approving sort of way. Scott frowned and looked out the window. Buck Covington smiled and looked from me to Mr. Doan and back. I held up my folder so that they could see the title. My choice for the first report was, I think, an obvious one. "Everyone is talking about the crows. Let's dig into it."
"A murder of crows," Phil Archer read. "Catchy."
"Short segments, just occasionally?"
Scott Palmer's frown was still in place.
"I don't get it."
Buck Covington looked puzzled.
"You want to murder them?"
"It means the same thing as a flock of crows, Buck,"
Phil Archer explained gently.
"It's just a term they use for a big group of them. I don't know why. Good idea, Lee."
Bruce Doan leaned back in his chair, hands behind his head.
"Damned good idea, Ms. Barrett. I see that you've already begun your research. I have every confidence that you can pull this off in great style. Let's see what you've got so far on the crows."
I'd read through my notes enough times so that I could rattle off crow facts pretty well without looking at the script too much. I held up photos and charts when appropriate, feeling like a first-grade teacher with a picture book at story hour. By the time I finished with details on methods of dispersing the roosting birds, including making scarecrows, hanging a dead crow in tree branches, and shooting off fireworks, I could tell that all four men were interested, engaged, and perhaps even a little bit excited by the idea.
"Good job, Ms. Barrett."
Mr. Doan reached for the folder with one hand, hit a button on his intercom with the other, summoned Rhonda to make four copies, then stood up.
"That's just for starters, gentlemen," he said. "Just for starters. I believe Lee here can do a series of investigative reports for us this summer. Once the city figures out how to get rid of the miserable creatures, and it had better be damned soon, she'll move on to something else."
So that was that. I had a summer job. Sort of a summer job. I stood to leave. "Thank you, Mr. Doan," I said. The three newsmen stood, murmured polite goodbyes, and left. Scott was the first one out the door.
"How about Thursday for your starting date? You seem to be ready, and with news we strike when the iron is hot, as they say."
Mr. Doan held a pen poised above a large desk calendar.
"That okay?"
"Sure," I said, only half believing it myself. "I can do that."
"Let's see. This is Tuesday. That'll be the day after tomorrow. If you need footage, get with Therese. Okay? Are we all set?"
"All set," I repeated. "Thursday."
"Right. We'll start with a live segment on the late news with Covington. Then run the short taped package Friday morning with Phil. Okay?"
"Okay. Fine. Thank you, Mr. Doan." My first investigative report with 2 days to prep and deliver. I felt something like opening night stage fright sweep over me and hoped my hand wasn't clammy when I shook his. Chapter 16. Aunt Ibby had some more news to deliver when I returned home. She must have been waiting for the sound of my key in the back door because she appeared in the hall even before Orion did.
"Guess what, Merrily? The crows ate up a tree in Gloria Tasker's yard, too. What do you think of that?"
"I don't know what to think," I said, picking up the cat and carrying him through her open kitchen door. "Did you hear that on the news?"
"No. One of my book club friends, Bertha Barnes, phoned and told me. She lives right next to Gloria's place in North Salem, and she saw the whole thing. Videoed some of it, too. Crows flew down onto Gloria's quince tree and stripped it bare in a matter of minutes."
My aunt didn't sound particularly sorry.
"Gloria was awfully proud of that tree. Used to enter her quince jam at the Topsfield Fair every year. Usually won a blue ribbon, too, though I always thought she used a touch too much cardamom."
I sat in one of the captain's chairs, Orion on my lap. "Slow down and back up a little, please," I said. "Is anybody living in Gloria's house now?"
"I don't think so. I didn't think to ask. But if the station doesn't have film, you can get my friend's video and scoop everybody. I asked her to email it to me and not to tell anyone else about it, and she said she would.
Having an exclusive piece of film like that is a big plus, and I was pleased. Doan would be too." "What would I do without you?" I said for the millionth time.
"Couldn't happen at a better time. I'm on the air on Thursday night. And maybe we can use her video for a promo tomorrow or even tonight."
"That came fast, didn't it?"
"I know. I'm a little nervous about it. But the crows are here right now, so the program has to be timely."
"You're right, of course. She's probably sent me the video by now. Better check it for quality and put together a short script and see what Mr. Doan wants to do with it."
She started for her office.
"Come on, let's take a look."
I carefully eased Orion down to the floor. He hates getting dumped from a lap without warning. He followed my aunt, and I brought up the rear. Within seconds, the video flashed on the screen. Aunt Ibby's book club friend was a darn good photographer. With steady hand and appropriately used zoom, she'd documented a textbook demonstration on how determined birds can denude a blossoming quince tree in minutes.
"This is great stuff."
I wasn't kidding. It was going to make excellent TV. "Is that Gloria's house in the background? Nice place." My aunt agreed.
"Easily the best house in the neighborhood, I'd say. Not sure how she could afford it on a waitress's salary. Want to watch this again?"
"Sure."
It was even better the second time. "This is going to be perfect. I'll slam together a few words about Thursday's investigative report segment and send the whole package right over to the station."
"Good idea. The video made me think about the trees and plants in our yard. I think I'll try my hand at making a scarecrow."
She put one fist under her chin, the way she does when she's thinking.
"When you get a minute,
would you run up into the attic and get a few things for me? There are some old jackets and pants on a clothes rack up there, and I'm pretty sure there's a floppy old straw hat in one of the trunks. Would you mind?
Not at all, I lied. I hate going into that attic. Partly it's because of the terrible fire that almost trapped Aunt Ibby and me up there. Even more frightening was the memory of the spellbook that I'd consigned to the flames that awful night. It was the real deal, the property of Bridget Bishop, the first Salem witch to die by hanging back in 1692. The book didn't burn. It should have, but it was unscathed by that inferno. The damned thing was evil, and I knew it. I hadn't told anyone but River about it, and I'd given it to her with a warning to hide it well. If Pete comes over later, we'll run upstairs and gather some scarecrow finery for you, I told my aunt. Meanwhile, I'll get this footage over to the station. So that's what I did. Mr. Doane was, as we expected, delighted with the neighbor's footage, who asked to remain anonymous so the rest of the people on her street wouldn't think she was peeking over their fences with her camera. Which maybe she was. I hurried home. I changed my shirt for a red silk one and drove back to the station and did a quick taping with Marty, explaining what my planned occasional investigative reports would attempt to do for the WICH-TV audience. There was, naturally, a special emphasis on Salem's current Murder of Crows problem, with mention of the recently deceased owner of the tree and her prize-winning quince jam. I voiced the hope that the tree would recover and that the crows would depart, resisting the temptation to report that both the apple tree and the quince tree stood on property owned by witches. By the time I'd parked the vet in the garage for what I hoped would be the final time for that long and busy day, sunset approached. Already the flapping of wings, the sudden motion of leaves and branches, and the cackling calling of the birds signaled a return to the roost. I ran, literally ran, along the path, through the garden, up the steps, and into the house, where Orion waited in the hall. Closing the door, I took a quick glance at the side fence. Three cats looked back at me, six eyes reflecting silvery circles in the dying light. I ducked into Aunt Ibby's kitchen for the fourth time since morning. "Just wanted to tell you how it went," I told her. "It's a 3-minute spot, and they're going to start running a 30-second teaser on the half-hour breaks tonight, then run the whole spot on the late news tonight, and several times tomorrow." "Wonderful," she said. "I expect that a good deal of tomorrow's local news will be coverage of Megan's service at Town Hall, so that should be just enough exposure to create interest in your report. River says that tomorrow's service will be a memorial for Megan, but later there'll be a real Wiccan ceremony." "Somewhere more private, I expect," my aunt said. "Somewhere where they can safely return her ashes to the earth. I've been doing a little research on the subject. It's a very special ceremony, a sacred passage leading from one life to the next. I expect that's why Elliot Bagginstow's left words that his remains be cremated. Claudine told me that at his funeral, although, of course, she didn't know then about his being, you know, one of them." "I wonder if Gloria Tasker was cremated, too. Pete might know." I decided I'd ask him, even if it was a nosy question. "River says they can hold the ceremony any time they choose." "Wiccans often hold the funerals on Halloween. Maybe Megan's will be then, or maybe not. She may have expressed her wishes about it to the members of her coven. Of course, if Gloria and Elliot hadn't admitted to being witches, I guess they didn't get any special ceremony." "Guess not. I'll be glad when all this is over. River is so stressed out." Orion stood beside the kitchen door, looked up at me, and meowed his impatient meow. "Okay, big boy," I said. "Let's go upstairs and relax. I'm tired. It's been a long day." "Is Pete coming over?" "Don't know for sure. He's been working a lot of hours lately.
He's probably tired, too. I kissed my aunt on the cheek, and yawning, I followed the cat up the curving wooden stairs to the third floor, through the living room, down the hall to the kitchen. Orion headed straight for the open window, turned around a couple of times, then sat on his haunches, facing the screen as he peered into the darkness. I started a fresh pot of decaf, nibbled on a graham cracker, and stood behind him. "What are you looking at out there? Are your girlfriends still on the fence? It sounds as though the crows have quieted down. I suppose they go to sleep after the sun sets." Orion swiveled his head around, blinked in my direction, making no cat comment, then returned his attention to the outdoors. I bent down so that my head was next to his, trying to see what it was that had captured such rapt concentration. At first I didn't see the black cat. She lay very still, all alone, along the top rail of the fence. She'd made herself small in that clever way only cats know how to do, facing Oliver Street and the trees where God only knows how many crows roosted. "What's she doing there all by herself, Orion?" I whispered. "Guarding them? Guarding us? Or is she just curious?" Again, no cat comment. The coffee maker signaled ready, and I poured a mugful just as Orion left his windowsill perch and streaked past me toward the living room, his signal that someone was coming. I followed, reaching the door just as Pete's key turned in the lock. I was glad to see him. His kiss told me that he was happy to see me, too. He stepped back, holding my shoulders, and gave me an admiring up-and-down glance.
"You look beautiful. Were you going out?"
"Thanks," I said. "I just got here myself. Seems like I've been going in and out all day. It's been a busy one. Come on in, I just made coffee."
"I could use it. I don't know why people think the police department can do anything about crow crap, but they do."
He took off his jacket, and slipping an arm around my waist, steered me back toward the kitchen.
"Tomorrow will be busy, too, what with Megan's funeral at Town Hall. Lots of traffic snarl-ups, parking problems."
I filled his mug, topped mine off, and put out a plate with a few almond biscotti while he hung his jacket in the closet and stashed his gun in the bureau. Orion returned to his observation point, and I sat in the lucite chair next to him while Pete took the one beside me.
"What's the cat looking at?"
he asked, leaning toward the window, shading his eyes with one hand and peering out.
"I don't see anything."
"I think he's watching that black cat on the back fence. See her?" He moved his chair closer to mine and looked past the cat, his face almost touching the screen.
"Nope, I don't."
He squinted.
"Oh yeah, there she is. Not moving a muscle. Think she's waiting to nab a crow for her dinner?"
"Strange," I said. "I hadn't thought of that. To me, she looked as though she was some kind of watch cat, like a guardian, a sentinel." He sipped his coffee, reached for a biscotti, and shook his head.
"I love the way your mind works, babe, but a cat is a cat."
He looked in Orion's direction.
"Oops. Present company accepted, of course."
"Of course," I agreed. "Everyone knows Orion is special. I'm thinking maybe the black cat is, too." A skeptical,
"Maybe."
Then taking a bite of the almond-flavored treat, he deftly changed the subject.
"This is okay, but is there anything a little more substantial to eat around here?"
"Nothing interesting," I admitted. "I feel like pizza. You?"
"I was thinking the same thing. Extra-large pepperoni with extra cheese."
"And a chef's salad?"
"How about a side of those fried mushrooms and those little breadstick things?"
"Good thinking. I'll call the pizza pirate," I said, tapping in the familiar number. I recited the order, adding a couple of liters of Pepsi. "It'll be here in 20 minutes, I reported. "One of us should wait in the downstairs hall. The delivery guy always comes to the front door."
"I'll go down,"
Pete volunteered. Should I ask your aunt to join us, since he'll be ringing her doorbell?
Yes, let's. She didn't mention that she had any plans for the evening.
There was music playing in the kitchen when I passed her door.
He smiled, his cute, crooked smile.
So, unless she's entertaining Cyndi Lauper in there, I think she's free.
Good call. Why don't you and Orion run down and invite her while I set the table? And if she offers to bring dessert, say yes.
Did I ever turn down one of your aunt's desserts? Come on, Orion.
The two stepped out into the front hall and started down the long, curving, polished stairway to the first floor. I turned my attention back to the open window and the black cat. She was still there, but had moved closer to the maple tree. The sounds from the roosting crows were muted by then, a kind of trilling with an occasional clicking sound. The temperature had fallen with the setting of the sun. It wasn't summer in Salem yet. I closed the window. I changed the silk blouse for a Boston Celtics t-shirt, and, quite sure Aunt Ibby would join us, set out silverware, 3 blue Fiestaware plates, and 3 cobalt thumbprint tumblers. Pizza calls for paper napkins instead of cloth, and I had some bright orange ones left over from Halloween. I stepped back from the table, admiring the contrasting colors, just as the downstairs doorbell chimed, "The Impossible Dream." Perfect timing. Within minutes, Orion dashed back into the kitchen via the cat door. Aunt Ibby, bearing a round covered dish with one hand, held the kitchen door open for Pete with the other. He balanced 4 boxes, topped with 2 soda bottles, and carefully set them all on the counter.
Smells good, huh?
It certainly did. Aunt Ibby and I hurried to dump the salad and mushrooms into serving bowls, and the breadsticks into a basket. We decided to leave the pizza in the box, and Pete plopped it unceremoniously onto the center of the table. Orion returned to the windowsill, where he watched the proceedings. "I'll just put the ambrosia in the refrigerator," my aunt said, opening the cover to display one of my childhood favorite desserts, resplendent with whipped topping, shredded coconut, walnuts, cherries, marshmallows, and other lovely things. Pete says his mother used to make it, too. Sometimes an impromptu supper with loved ones, a blue jeans, paper napkins, pizza box on the table, sugary homemade dessert, and Pepsi in blue glasses meal, easily beats a dressed-up, fancy wine-list dinner at Mistral. This felt like one of those nights. "Seems as though all anyone in Salem talks about these days is the crows," Aunt Ibby said, accepting a slice of pizza. "I suppose you've heard about the quince tree that they stripped?"
"Sure did."
Pete poured soda into her glass.
"The tree belonged to that woman who died in a hit and run, Gloria Tasker. One of her neighbors reported it."
"Mara Lee has a video for her TV debut, Day After Tomorrow," my aunt said, smiling broadly. "Don't you, dear?"
"Your TV debut? So soon?"
Pete's dark eyes widened.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"We started talking about cats and pizza, and I just didn't get to it, I guess. This day has been crazy busy."
"Oh, babe."
He reached for my hand and squeezed it.
"I'm sorry. Here I'm whining about crow poop and traffic jams, and you've got important news. Tell me everything."
Then a sudden frown and a quick switch to cop voice.
"What do you mean you've got video?"
I had to laugh at the transition. "Hey, I'm an investigative reporter now, remember? Confidential source. Anyway, Doan and the whole news crew approved my pitch on a murder of crows, and Doan wants it for Day After Tomorrow. The anonymous video just landed at the right time. I'll show it to you if you like."
"Of course. Sounds interesting. So, what else happened on this busy day?"
"Normal Pete," voice was back. I put a spoonful of fried mushrooms on top of my pizza and took a bite. "Oh, God, this is good. Well, we picked out all the wedding dresses this morning, but I guess you don't want to hear about that.
Later, I had a phone call from Dakota's best man. The frown was back in place.
Madigan?
Yes, he wants to meet me before the wedding.
Meet you? Why?
I shrugged. Just best man maid of honor protocol, I guess. Says we'll have to walk down the aisle together, so we may as well get acquainted.
What did you say?
It was a voicemail. I haven't called him back yet. What do you think I should say?
Tell him you'll meet him at the rehearsal.
Pete growled, tearing a bite from a breadstick.
Or at least get Shannon or Dakota to introduce you.
In some proper public place, Aunt Ibby offered. After all, the man is an admitted thief. Okay, I'll ask Shannon to set up a meeting at the Hawthorne Coffee Shop, or maybe at the Pig's Eye. That earned a grudging,
okay,
from Pete, and Aunt Ibby commented that the Pig's Eye would be convenient to the TV station. Should I be worried about him, Pete? Is there anything I should know?
No.
His smile was back.
I'm just a little overprotective where you're concerned. We've been keeping an eye on him ever since he got here.
Has he been in Salem very long, Pete? Aunt Ibby wanted to know.
About a month or so.
He said,
clean as a whistle as far as we can tell, staying away from museums. But now that he's moved to the Dumas place in Marblehead, he's out of my jurisdiction.
The wedding is going to be at the Dumas place, I said. I guess it's really nice, beachfront and a pretty gazebo, according to Shannon. It's going to be on June 21st. Pete's eyebrows shot up. Cop voice.
Gazebo? That gazebo?
I can't be positive, but I'm pretty sure it is. Oh, dear, Aunt Ibby said, retrieving the cut glass bowl from the refrigerator. Let's talk of more pleasant things, like dessert. Then maybe after dessert and coffee, you two could go up to the attic and select an appropriate outfit for my scarecrow.
Not going to wait for the fireworks, Mrs. Russell?
I believe in being proactive, Pete, she said. Scarecrows work wonderfully well sometimes. Couldn't hurt to try it. Apparently our garden doesn't have the protection that Proctor's Ledge enjoys.
That's a strange thing, isn't it?
Pete picked up the empty pizza box, clearing a space for the ambrosia, and started a fresh pot of coffee.
Almost like the witches are protecting the place where they died.
Bridget Bishop was the first to go, I said, hardly realizing that I'd spoken the words aloud. Oops, sorry. We weren't going to talk about that stuff. Poor Bridget, Aunt Ibby said. All of them suffered such dreadful indignities. And you're right, Bridget was the first. It's no wonder she was so angry with her accusers. Angry enough to cause peculiar accidents and mysterious deaths for some of them, I said. Ariel Constellation claimed that Bridget was most certainly a witch. At the mention of Ariel, his late mistress's name, Orion flattened his ears, and his golden eyes seemed to grow larger.
Whoop!
He said, nodding his big, fuzzy head.
Whoop!
Orion seems to agree about that, my aunt said. Sometimes, I wonder.
What did she do that was so bad that she got accused of, you know, witchcraft?
Pete asked, taking a spoonful of dessert.
Oh, wow. This is just like my mom used to make.
Glad you like it. Aunt Ibby tasted hers. Haven't made this in years. To answer your question, Pete, I think Bridget's main problem was that she was pretty. She owned a couple of successful taverns, liked to party, and when she tended bar, wore a bright red corset over her Puritan black dress. My brain clicked into overdrive. Like the bright red bustier River wore over her black velvet dress? Chapter 17. After Aunt Ibby left, Pete and I finished off the pot of coffee, put the cartons into the recycling bin, and loaded the dishwasher.
That was fun,
he said.
I love spending time with you like this. You and your cat, and your aunt, too. It's so easy, you know?
I know exactly what you mean, I said.
Easy is the right word.
We're good together.
He pulled me close. Yes, I said. We are. Orion chose that moment to interrupt with a long bit of cat dialogue, something like,
meow, 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 meow,
while repeatedly slipping in and out of his door.
What's up with him?
Pete still held me, but seemed fascinated with the cat antics going on across the room.
I know what he's doing. I sighed. He wants us to go upstairs and get the clothes for Aunt Ibby's scarecrow.
Oh, yeah.
He kissed my forehead and stepped away.
Let's get it over with.
I knew I was right about Orion's intention. We followed him out of the kitchen and down the carpeted hall to the door leading to the attic. I paused, closed my eyes for a moment, and grasped Pete's hand. Thank you for coming up there with me. I still dread this place. I know it's crazy after all this time, but...
No, not crazy at all. You damn near lost your life up there. When I think of how I almost lost you, I feel sick.
Well, anyway, here we go on a scarecrow suit hunt. I managed a smile, pulled the door open, flipped on the light switch, and together we started up the stairs. Orion lay down beside the door, not making a move to join us. He doesn't like the attic either. The smell of smoke and scorched wood had long ago been replaced with the pleasant smell of pine floorboards and fresh paint. The hodgepodge of odds and ends of old furniture, trunks, and boxes and bags of miscellany spanning generations were all gone. Nothing could have survived the heat and flames of that Halloween night. Nothing. Except Bridget Bishop's spellbook. I shivered, and Pete put his arm around my shoulders.
You're cold. Want to do this some other time?
No, let's get it over with. It shouldn't take long. Look at all these racks and bureaus. The attic was much more orderly now, well lit, with clothes in neat plastic garment bags on rolling clothes racks, and a row of identical bureaus, each with 8 drawers. A long metal cart, like the ones they use in airports, held an assortment of suitcases, briefcases, and backpacks. Some of the bureau drawers were even marked with labels indicating their contents. Here, this one says hats. We can start dressing our guy from the top down. Pete pulled the drawer open, and we selected a bright yellow, wide-brimmed straw hat I remembered Aunt Ibby wearing on a trip to the Florida Keys.
A little effeminate for a scarecrow, I guess, but it'll flop nicely in the breeze.
I agreed, and we moved on to one of the racks. The next few minutes produced a man's suit in navy blue polyester. What was my maiden aunt doing with it? Don't know, and we'll never ask, but we decided it would look fine, stuffed with straw. A red silk ascot tie provided a jaunty touch.
Do scarecrows wear shoes?
Pete asked, holding up a pair of black and white wingtips. I don't think so, but take them anyway. Let's get out of here. Pete rolled the clothes up and tucked them under his arm along with the shoes and plunked the yellow hat onto my head.
Job well done. He'll be the coolest scarecrow on the block.
Hope he does his job and scares them all away. We started down the stairs with Pete in the lead.
If he doesn't, I have a few cherry bombs left over from last 4th of July,
he offered,
and a couple of giant sparklers.
Might take you up on that, I said, turning off the light switch and firmly closing the door. Orion stood, stretched, and trotted down the hall ahead of us. Especially the sparklers. They're so pretty.
Not supposed to be pretty. Supposed to be scary, remember? We're trying to scare crows, not entertain them,
he teased. Bridget Bishop was pretty, yet she really frightened people. Why else would they have killed her? Back in the comfort of the apartment, surrounded by familiar things, I began to relax. We put the suit, scarf, and shoes into a paper bag, topped off with a yellow hat. I put the whole thing next to the living room door with a reminder to Pete to drop it off in the downstairs hall when he left for work in the morning.
"You want to tell me about the gazebo at the Dumas place now?"
he asked.
"I guess your aunt didn't want to hear about it."
"There's really nothing to tell," I said. "I haven't actually seen it yet. Maybe it isn't the same one. Maybe it's just a coincidence that there's a gazebo at the site of Shannon's wedding. Maybe it's a coincidence that guests are going to be wearing black and the dead man in the vision is in a black tux. I don't know. I'm too tired to even think about it anymore."
"I'm beat too,"
Pete said.
"It's probably all a big coincidence."
He doesn't believe in coincidences, and this time I don't either. I looked at the Kit Kat clock. "Time for the late news. We can watch my promo from bed."
"Works for me."
The quince tree stripping sequence was even creepier than I'd thought it would be. Marty had sped up the action, so it appeared as though that poor tree had been denuded in seconds. I looked all right, and sounded as though I knew what I was talking about. It was, I thought, a darn good 30-second promo for my debut as an investigative reporter. Pete agreed enthusiastically. We turned off the TV without watching the rest of the news, and I fell happily, safely, and confidently asleep in strong, loving arms, where no crows, no witches, no visions could touch me. Wednesday morning was quite another matter. At first, everything seemed normal enough. Pete was the first one up and started the coffee. He makes it better than I do anyway. I grabbed my robe and went downstairs to my old bathroom on the second floor to shower while Pete used the one in the apartment. Orion passed me on the stairway on his way down to Aunt Ibby's, where he preferred the breakfast menu. It wasn't until I was back in my own kitchen that I noticed the silence. The coffee maker gurgled. The Kit Kat clock's tail tick-tocked back and forth. Otherwise, the room was still. I opened the window. No cawing or cackling. Not even a peep. Where were the birds? I lifted the screen, stuck my head out over the fire escape, and looked toward Oliver Street and our maple tree, where a crowd of crows had gathered the night before. Green leaves ruffled by a slight breeze. No crows. Had the city fathers and mothers learned how to make them go away so soon? How? I'd have to figure it out before my broadcast, that was for sure. I closed the screen and went back to the bedroom to dress for the day, for Megan's town hall service. Maybe I'd watch the early news while I decided what to wear. I pulled my old standby little black dress from the closet, held it up in front of me, and studied my reflection in the mirror. I really dislike black, so the LBD is the only black item in my wardrobe. Maybe with a gold belt and a blue silk scarf. Megan liked blue. The swirling colors and sparkling lights began immediately. I sat on the edge of the bed and watched the vision come into focus. It was Megan, but such a different Megan. The bent and wizened body was upright and supple, and the thinning hair, now a snowy white nimbus, framed an unlined, fine-boned face. Bright violet eyes sparkled where dull, unseeing ones had been. She stretched a smooth, unblemished right hand toward me, and a crow, wings fluttering, alighted on her wrist. She moved her hand back slowly until the bird sat on her shoulder, where she stroked shining black feathers. Her smile was kind, benevolent, as it had always been. With her left hand, she made a graceful motion toward the bird. Instantly, it disappeared. Didn't fly away or fade away, it simply disappeared. She looked straight at me and winked one of those startling violet eyes. Chapter 18. I sat there on the edge of my bed, leaning closer to the mirror. Megan waved her hand again, and the crow reappeared on her shoulder, Then they both disappeared, just as rapidly and completely as the crow had moments before. Once again, the only reflection there was my own, a puzzled redhead in a bathrobe.
"What are you trying to tell me, Megan?"
Pete walked into the bedroom, shirtless, hair wet from his shower, humming a slightly off-key version of Rhinestone Cowboy. He selected a white shirt from the armoire, then turned toward me.
"Do I have any decent neckties here, babe?"
He cocked his head, studying my face, then sat down next to me.
"You okay? You look, a little confused."
A handsome, shirtless, nice-smelling, well-muscled man on your bed can snap you out of muddled thinking immediately. "I'm fine," I said, just deciding what to wear for Megan's service. I gestured toward the LBD, now draped across the pillows.
"Yep, that's why I need a tie."
He looked from me to the mirror and back.
"Uh-oh, you've been seeing things again."
He sat beside me, putting an arm around my shoulders.
"Want to tell me about it?"
"Yes, I do," I said. "But, as usual, I don't know what it means." I tried to describe what I'd just seen, aware, as always, that I was talking to a detective, attentive to every detail.
"The crow was there, on her shoulder."
He repeated what I'd told him.
"Then it disappeared?"
I nodded. "Yes. Then she waved her hand again, and it came back."
"And disappeared again?"
"Yes."
"So Megan made it come and go by waving her hand?"
"Yes." I stood up then, excited, understanding. I took his hand. "Yes! Come on in and look out the window. You'll see. They're gone. The crows are gone. They've disappeared, just like the crow she showed me." He followed me, and once again I raised the screen. "Look over toward Oliver Street. The trees were full of them. They're gone now. See?" He stuck his head out the window just as I had.
"You're right."
He lowered the screen.
"Let's turn on the news and see if it's happening anywhere else."
I clicked on the kitchen TV, and Pete poured us each a cup of coffee. The commercial for the Gulu Gulu Cafe seemed to go on forever. "Come on, come on," I muttered. "Tell us about the crows." Phil Archer did just that.
"City officials, representatives of the Audubon Society, and biologists from the USDA are meeting at this hour in an attempt to understand what's happened to the giant influx of crows that have plagued this city for several days."
Behind the veteran newsman, the video of the Proctor's Ledge roost played, complete with the grating, raucous sounds of the crows.
"According to the mayor, none of the suggested remedies for dispersing the roosts have yet been employed, although individual citizens have tried various means on their own. Officials are attempting to gather information on these methods to determine whether one or more of them may have had the desired effect."
"Your aunt hasn't even had a chance to make her scarecrow yet."
Pete shrugged into his shirt.
"She'll be disappointed."
I'd found a few of Pete's neckties in my closet. I handed him a blue and white striped one. "Here, Megan's favorite color was blue. Let's give Aunt Ibby the scarecrow outfit anyway. The crows will be back."
"You think so?"
"I do." I pointed to the TV. "Look, he's going to show my promo." Phil Archer gave a quick introduction to the video, explaining that my investigative reports would be a continuing feature. Marty had provided a wonderfully creepy title screen with gothic lettering proclaiming, "A Murder of Crows." "It looks good, doesn't it?"
"Are you kidding? It looks amazing. So do you."
He leaned down and kissed me.
"Do I look all right?"
I straightened his tie. "Perfect," I said, meaning it. "I'll look for you at Town Hall."
"There'll be a crowd. Boston TV stations, even the big networks and all that. Megan was pretty famous for being Salem's oldest witch."
"She'll be missed," I said, thinking again of the way I'd seen her in the mirror. Not just because she was old.
I know. I've got to get going. I'll grab breakfast later.
He retrieved his gun from its hiding place, adjusted his holster, and donned his jacket.
I'll take the bag of clothes down to your aunt on my way out. Megan's service is at 10. It's nearly 8:30.
He tugged on the collar of my bathrobe.
Better think about getting dressed yourself, sleepyhead.
Yep, I got distracted there for a minute. He pulled me close again.
I understand.
His voice was gruff.
I wish you didn't have to see those things.
Me too, but I'm starting to get used to it. They don't freak me out as much as they used to. I realized, as I spoke the words, that they were true. I was actually getting used to the visions. That didn't mean I liked them, though. I walked with Pete and Orion to the living room and watched from the doorway as they disappeared down the back stairs. Back in my kitchen, once again, in my bathrobe, I sat in the chair next to the window. The TV was still tuned to the news. My coffee was nearly cold, but I sipped it anyway. Phil Archer had moved on to coverage of the school committee's annual budget requests, but I barely heard his words. In my mind, I replayed the scene in the mirror, Megan stroking the crow's feathers and giving me that conspiratorial wink as the bird disappeared and reappeared and disappeared again. I stood and once again lifted the screen and leaned as far out of the window as I could. First I looked toward Oliver Street, then in the other direction toward Winter Street. No crows either way. I knew they'd be back, though. That's what the vision meant. I smiled. I may not welcome the visions, but I was getting better at figuring them out. Aunt Ibby and I had decided to walk to Town Hall rather than try to find a parking space on downtown Salem's crowded streets. It was a perfect day for a walk, cloudless and cool. The street sweepers had been out early, so the long Essex Street pedestrian mall between Hawthorne Boulevard and Washington Street was reasonably free of bird droppings. I'd paired my LBD and baby blue silk scarf with the blue kitten heels. My aunt, wearing a beige linen pantsuit and tan sandals, looked stylish and trim as always. Essex Street offers some super window shopping. There are antiques and gift stores, clothing boutiques, the ubiquitous witch shops, and even a world-class museum. We chatted about the absence of crows, and she thanked me for the scarecrow duds, saying she'd decided to make one anyway. There's always a chance they'll be back. After all, apparently nobody knows what scared them away. It seemed like a good time to tell her about the Megan vision. So I did. I'm sure it means they'll be back, I told her when I was through. Sooner or later. We paused in front of an art gallery, admiring an Emile Gruppe harbor scene. Have you arranged a meeting with that Madigan art thief person yet? She asked. No, I haven't. Actually, it slipped my mind. So much has been going on. True. I guess it can wait. The wedding is still a couple of weeks away, isn't it? Right. June 21st. Shannon got the invitations done at a quick print place. Sent them in overnight mail. You should get yours tomorrow. She made a tisk-tisk sound. In my day, the properly engraved invitations were sent at least 2 months in advance. I know. It all seems kind of rushed, but it had to be at a time when Shannon's dad would be in town. He travels a lot. Dakota likes the date because it's the longest day of sunshine. The Dumas house is beautiful, as I recall. Saw it on a tour of Marblehead homes once. Did you see Poe's aviary? Or maybe a gazebo on the property? No, they just show you certain rooms, then move on to the next mansion. Well, you'll get a good look at the whole place at the wedding. I'm looking forward to it. We emerged onto cobblestoned Front Street, where the old town hall stands. The publicity brochures call it the Jewel of Derby Square. It's been there since 1816. And though it's not used for official city business anymore,
It's often the scene of weddings and other celebrations. Pete was right about the traffic. It was bumper to bumper, and mobile units from a couple of Boston TV stations along with